Hello, fellow law nerds. Welcome to another episode of Boom Lawyered, a Rewired.News podcast hosted by the legal journalism team, half of which has been binge-watching Survivor for about a month now, and please send help. I'm Imani Gandhi.
And I'm Jess Piclo. Rewired.News is dedicated to bringing you the best reproductive rights and social justice news, commentary, and analysis on the web. And the Team Legal podcast is part of that mission. So a big thank you to our subscribers and a welcome to our new listeners.
So today we thought we'd shake things up a little bit and do a sort of mailbag episode. We asked you to pose some questions in our Facebook group, Boom Lawyered, which you should totally join, by the way. And we're going to answer some of those questions. So let's get to it. First up, we have a question from Tracy, and they ask us, are we ever going to see our way out of this horror show we're in? Or is this the end? Is this it? Well, Jess, I'm going to let you take that one because my answer is going to be like, oh, God.
Oh, no. I mean, it's hard to see the end right now, right? I got to say this question, the first thing that popped into my mind, because I'm in like sort of full nihilism mode, is the scene in Armageddon when the two shuttles are like, and the one ends up like crash landing on the asteroid and the co-pilot is like, this is it. He's like coming to terms with his death. I don't think we're there yet.
So you're saying we're not astronauts hurtling towards an asteroid in outer space?
No.
Okay, good.
It's bad, but it could be worse.
Okay, so we're not going to have to pull a Bruce Willis.
I do. I think, for example, but there's some tangible things. Like, I think it is really, I am taking hope, for example, in the fact that reform to the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary is not just a throwaway talking point among Democratic candidates right now, that this is something that is serious in terms of addressing policy, and that is one thing we're going to have to do. So the idea that, you know, folks like Elizabeth Warren are out there saying, hey, you know what, we may have to restructure the court, I think is a sign that there are folks with positions in power who do understand the gravity of the situation. And it's going to be a while, but we do and can, if we've got the will, see our way out of it.
I'm going to agree with Jessica, but just say that it is going to be tough.
Yeah.
You know, the road ahead is fraught with peril. And we don't want to sugarcoat it, but at the same time,
nope.
You know, you got to remain a little bit optimistic. Otherwise, it's like, why not just defenestrate yourself, right?
So, seriously. And I mean, I think Imani and I have both said that we think 2019 especially is going to be like a rough year. So everybody be real good to yourselves.
Yes, please.
But, you know, there are pathways out and we're starting to find them, I think.
Next up, we have a question from Rosita, who asks us, how can we get around recent FDA restrictions on mifepristone and other abortion pills mailed from abroad and from more liberal states to southern states with more restrictions?
Wow, this is a great question.
It's an excellent question. First, we have to say, we cannot advise you to break the law.
Don't.
We're not going to advise you to break the law. That said, there are groups out there that do deal with this sort of thing. There's an organization called Women Help Women. You can go to their website, www.abortionpillinfo.com. And what they're going to do is they're going to let you know that there are many states in which the law requires that abortion pills be provided to you by licensed healthcare clinicians, even though it doesn't seem like that's necessary because it's a pretty easy, you take a pill and then the next day take another pill. It's not that fucking hard, right? But We know how it is when it comes to restricting the ability of people of reproductive rights age to access these healthcare options. So Women Help Women, they will sort of guide you through what you need to do in order to get abortion pills, what you need to do to avoid breaking the law. And, you know, just please, we must reiterate, don't break the law, because women have been arrested for using these pills and they have been jailed for using these pills. So it's a very sort of treacherous area to be in. And it's unfortunate we don't live like in Poland where they're dropping abortion pills from drones, because that would be amazing if we could have that sort of infrastructure here. But we don't. So if you're overseas, you probably have more options. If you're listening to us in America, in North America, I would say, in the United States, I would suggest you go to abortionpillinfo.com.
And also, I would just add to that that it's possible to have multiple doses of Plan B on hand. And that's still, for now, over the counter. And obviously a much shorter window of efficacy and when you can use it. But it is something that, you know, is just maybe not a bad idea these days.
Absolutely. Thanks for the question, Rosita.
Yeah, excellent.
Next up, we have a question from Mike, who asks, do you foresee any action being taken against Spuds McCavanaugh? That's a good one. Do you foresee any action being taken against Spuds McCavanaugh for the allegations of perjury and inappropriate action that came up during his confirmation hearing? Jessica.
No. I mean, so we're in a bad spot here with this. First of all, we don't have any ethical rules that apply directly to sitting Supreme Court justices. So, you know, with no ethical canon to bind them, we don't have that kind of enforcement mechanism. Now, you know, and nothing that happened in terms of the professional responsibility complaints that got, you know, kicked over to the 10th Circuit, those have all gone away once Spuds McCavanaugh was confirmed. That said, we do have political options. And again, you know, elections have consequences, and Democrats are in charge of the House. And there was a lot of unanswered questions from Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings. Who paid off all those debts, for example? You know, so if we have investigatory power and if we learn things through that process, we may have political will to get him off the bench. But those are a lot of things that have to line up. And frankly, there's got to be a big stomach for that fight. And Democrats have a bunch of fights that they're going to have. I don't know where that falls in their priority. I don't know, Imani, what do you think?
Yeah, I know. I just know. I don't think so. I think it's really interesting. Well, first of all, there are some ethical rules that I think that Roberts is considering, right? So there are some yes. rules that may be put in place. Whether those rules will be retroactive or not is a question. It could be that, you know, Spuds is just grandfathered in and whatever shit that he did during his confirmation hearing is sort of off the table. But yeah, it's just... There's, as Jess said, the Democrats, I don't think they have the stomach for this particular fight because they have so many other fights. And I think that, you know, I'm not sure if this is happening, but it seems to me that either Roberts is keeping Spuds quiet or Spuds has decided to keep himself quiet for a while in order to sort of let all of the bad juju from the confirmation hearing pass over. So I think, and I'm not sure, Jess, you may disagree. I haven't actually floated this with you, but I think it's interesting that the court hasn't taken any of those Title VII cases
mm-hmm.
this term, because I feel like they're trying to give Kavanaugh, they haven't yet anyway, right?
Yeah.
It seems like they're trying to give Kavanaugh like a year to just sort of get comfortable before he comes in on his second term and starts just like decimating rights, which I honestly think is, you know, on the horizon. So I think we're stuck with Spuds.
We are stuck with Spuds. I think so. I do think, Imani, you're right that, you know, with all of the drama around the confirmation fight and, you know, just the court in general, we've got an administration that is like, ah, fuck it. I'm just going to go straight to the Supreme Court. Who cares about proper appellate procedure? You know, with all of that kind of stuff happening, I do really think that Chief Justice John Roberts has tried to pump the brakes a little bit this term. I think, frankly, though, that's going to be next to impossible for him to do next term, even if they don't take a bunch of high-profile cases or if they only take one or two. I just think that, you know, we saw Kavanaugh's personality in that confirmation hearing. We saw that rageful, angry man, and there you just can't contain that. So we'll see that. Unfortunately, yeah, we're stuck with him.
Yeah, and that Hooray. Rage, that ragefulness that was aimed directly at Democrats. Like, do you yeah. remember where he was yelling about Democrats and Hillary Clinton is behind all of this? I mean, I have not forgotten yeah. that. But I suspect a lot of Americans will have forgotten that by the time he starts being like, sure, it's okay for employers to fire you if you're gay and that sort of thing. So,
and lest we think, like, this is, I'm just going to go into the weeds real quick because I can't help myself, but lest we think that that was like a one-off Kavanaugh thing, like being pissed at the Clintons, you know, this week in the court, we got a big immigrant rights decision that, you know, said effectively immigrants can be held indefinitely and then, you know, grabbed by ICE. And we haven't covered that extensively at all. We've got a little bit of coverage of it over at Rewire.news on the site. But in his opinion, Kavanaugh blames Clinton for the statute. You know, he's like, so we will see this kind of weird, ugly partisanship from him next term. And I don't know, like maybe, you know, get to back to the question of if we're stuck with him, maybe enough partisanship and some stuff, if there is some subpoenas and investigations that happen. I don't know, like, it's been a wild couple of years already. I didn't think we'd be this far, so who the hell knows, right, Imani?
Yeah, seriously, who the hell knows? Thank you for that question, Mike. Our next question comes from Aaron, who asks us, are there any laws we're stuck with forever and ever, amen, that once declared cannot be undeclared? They go on to say, I guess I need reassurance that this current shit show can be fixed. Jessica.
It can be fixed. Statutes can be written. They can be amended. Even the Constitution can be amended.
Yep.
If we get really into it. So things can be fixed. Yes. But what does fixing look like, right? Like, so that's a process. There's a political process. And there's the reality that there's time in that. And we're stuck with the mess while the fixing is happening. The mess like Brad McBeer on the court for however long. You know, the mess of what happens now that we have largely told school districts that they can kind of go their own way in implementing Title IX protections for trans students. What does that look like in local school jurisdictions? You know, that's what we're stuck with right now. And it will, and, you know, wading out of that from a policy perspective is going to take some time. But our federal agencies can do it and Congress can do it.
Also, another thing that I think is important to note is that there are Democratic candidates who have been talking seriously about expanding the Supreme Court. Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, and Pete. God, I can't say your last name. I'm so sorry, Mayor Pete.
Mayor Pete.
I'm sorry, Mayor Pete. But they are just a few of the Democratic candidates who have actually entertained the prospect of expanding the court. And actually, just this morning, our favorite Orange Menace said that he wasn't considering expanding the court, that he wasn't going to expand the Supreme Court. Now, that said, that man changes his opinion as fast as he changes his underwear. So tomorrow, if Fox and Friends is like, yeah, Donald Trump should expand the Supreme Court, he'll probably get on Twitter and be like, I'm expanding the Supreme Court today. 35 judges and they'll all be Republicans. And then we can all just throw ourselves out windows. But, you know, there are some possibilities there. But again, as Jess said, it's a long road. There's a lot of process that goes involved. And you can bet your sweet ass that Republicans are not going to expand the court without a lot of pushback. Because right now they've got a 5-4 majority.
Right.
And so why would they want to mess with that?
One of the things that, should the election go well in 2020, though, that Democrats could do that would help kickstart that, that, you know, while the fight over legislation is happening and, you know, while the fight over the court is happening, is the federal agencies under Democratic guidance could reverse course on some of the most terrible decisions that we've seen in terms of rulemaking. And so I'm just going to ask that if you are curious about that, you go back and listen to our episode on administrative law, because it will answer.
Because Jess loves it and it's sexy.
It's so sexy, but it's so important. Like, the agency stuff that's happened under this administration is so important. And when we're talking about how the fuck do we get out of all of this, the agencies are going to be on the front lines of doing that. So, all right, there's your agency law plug.
She's going to plug agency law and in every episode if possible. Our next question comes from Caitlin, who asks, how soon are we going to see the effects of all the conservative lower court judges that Turtle McEvil, you guys have really good
these are the best
names. Okay, how soon are we going to see the effects of all the conservative lower court judges that Turtle McEvil has pushed through in the last 2 years? Is it something that's already happening and just flying under the radar because it's not SCOTUS, or are things going to slowly build up? Jessica.
Oh, this is a great question. It is already happening. Let's talk about this, because this is, aside from agency laws, like my other, you know, sort of big moment in or area. So 1 in 6 circuit judges now, Imani, are Trump appointees. 1 in 6.
Okay, I had a little mini tantrum. 1 in 6, y'all. I mean, I feel like that's one of the areas that really has flown under the radar that people aren't talking enough about, which is the wave after wave after wave of judicial nominees that are just being shoved into the courts. People who really have no business being there. We're talking ABA unqualified people. Like, the ABA has come out and said, you know what? These people are not qualified to be judges.
Yeah.
But yet, there they are. There they sit, making rules for, you know, multiple states, depending on what circuit they sit in, or, you know, the federal government if they sit in the DC circuit. I mean, it is really frightening how many Trump appointees are sitting on courts.
And we are, and so we have, we can give you a very specific example even. So the Sixth Circuit recently, the entire Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals came out and said that Ohio could just go gangbusters and defund Planned Parenthood. And it released a terrible decision that is, I mean, it's radical, in its reach. And without going...
You should explain why it's radical.
Yeah, so without going too far into the weeds on the case, here's the TLDR on the Ohio Planned Parenthood fight in the Sixth Circuit. You remember those terrible CMP, the Center for Medical Progress videos, right? So those came out, and John Kasich and the Ohio legislature said, that's terrible, Planned Parenthood is a criminal enterprise, and we're going to defund them. And then Planned Parenthood said, that's unconstitutional, you can't do that, we have certain rights. The lower court said, hey, Ohio, that's unconstitutional, you can't do that, Planned Parenthood as an abortion provider has certain rights. And the state of Ohio didn't like that, and they appealed it to the Sixth Circuit. And three judges on the Sixth Circuit, or two of three judges on the Sixth Circuit panel said, hey, Ohio, you can't do that. And in between that decision and the time when the full Sixth Circuit decided to take it up, Trump got a whole bunch of new appointees to the Sixth Circuit. Four of them, as a matter of fact. And lo and behold, what happens when the full Sixth Circuit hears it? They say, hey, you know what, Ohio, go gangbusters. You actually can do that. And abortion providers, you don't have the kind of constitutional rights to provide abortions that you think you do and that the law has historically recognized.
Which is absurd.
Like, it's absurd.
I mean, I read the opinion. You know, what they said is like, you know, abortion providers don't have a due process right to perform abortions. Well, I mean, what are you talking about? First of all, there is like a long line of cases that say abortion providers' rights are derivative of their patients, right?
Right.
They sue to uphold, you know, the constitutional right to choose on behalf of their patients. So it's not a matter of whether or not the providers have a due process right to perform abortion. The issue is whether or not patients have a due process right to have to be able to obtain abortions. And in order to vindicate that due process right, they have to be able to go to someone who will perform the abortion. Having the right to get an abortion doesn't make a difference if there's no one who can perform it, right? And so that's been the rule for a long time.
Yeah, when we talk about the right being derivative, Imani, that's exactly what we're talking about, right? Like, the right to an abortion means nothing if there's no right to access it. So in the way in which the rights play together, provider rights and patient rights are in some ways inextricably woven to that. And the law has recognized it, I mean, forever. And so, you know, I mean, just it's to, without even getting into the constitutional weeds on it, you can see how radical it is just by carrying the logic out. So what effectively the Sixth Circuit said is, yes, a right to abortion exists. No, abortion providers, you don't have a sort of separate constitutional due process guarantee in doing your work. What that means is the state can do whatever it needs to do to make it impossible for you, you know, effectively, up until the point when that becomes an undue burden on patient rights. But that framework requires the patients to enforce it, not the providers. And that is the kind of intellectual fuckery that the Trump appointees are enacting on the federal courts right now. And so that was just, you know, this month. Right? We have cases in the pipeline in the Fifth Circuit, in the Eighth Circuit, where they've gotten a bunch of judges, you know, in the First Circuit, which is in the Northeast. We are going to see this ripple effect. And now they're gunning for the Ninth Circuit. So,
yeah, I was literally just about to say, and they're coming for the Ninth, you know, because a lot of the big cases that have, you know, shut down some of Trump's policy initiatives, the travel ban, the Muslim ban.
Yep.
The attorneys generals of states like Washington and California file those suits. So they will be in the Ninth Circuit, because the Ninth Circuit is sort of notorious for being a very liberal circuit. Well, not anymore. I mean, it's moving to the middle. If Trump hasn't, I mean, Trump, you know, he was saying he wanted to split up the Ninth Circuit. So if he can get more conservative judges on the Ninth Circuit, well, you know, that's what he's going to do. So we're already seeing it. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like a national discussion, I think that a lot of this stuff is flying under the radar, which is why we have podcasts like Boom Lawyered for you lovely people to come and get the information that you need to have before the shit completely hits the fan. So you can at least maybe, I don't know, get some like plastic covering and shield yourself from all of the flying shit. That's a really gross analogy.
It's so gross. I remember during, you know, the halcyon days of the Obama administration when I was covering the federal judiciary, and I would like get so excited about the idea of covering judicial nominations in the fights because, yes, I mean, it's totally nerdy and it's and that is all my jam, but also because it was something that didn't happen a whole lot. And now I've lost track, sincerely. Like, I do not know what wave of judicial nominations we have gone through. I know we are at least through 15 waves. That, you know, that's Trump, but that's, you know, Republicans working absolutely hand in hand with him. And Imani, you and I will not see a change, I think, in the federal courts going back in a good direction in our lifetime, unfortunately.
No, we won't. So sorry if you're like 40 and above. So, yeah, thanks for that question.
Yeah.
Was that Caitlin's question? Yes, that was Caitlin's question. The next question comes from Christy, who asks, what's the best way for residents of blue states to make sure their state laws related to reproductive health care are as strong as possible in the wake of all these terrible laws being passed across the country?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, too. So, you know, I think, yes, absolutely. If you are in blue states, blue state legislatures should be doing everything they can to shore up reproductive rights and access. And that means making sure not just that there's, you know, a codification of Roe v. Wade on the books, right? That's a state statute that says we recognize at the state level that there's a fundamental right to abortion. States are doing that. But it's also making sure, you know, that your states aren't doing things with regard to conscious refusals and expansions, because we're seeing attacks on anti-discrimination laws and reproductive rights protections through this weaponization of the First Amendment and religious objections. And Imani and I have talked about it a lot. So that's another area. And then also drill down to the local. What's your school board doing about how it's teaching sex ed and consent and things like that? Like, you know, I've got a 14-year-old boy, and this is a wild time.
Wait, he's 14 now?
He's 14.
Oh my God.
He's going to be a freshman in high school. It's wild.
Oh my God, I saw him and he was still like 11 or 12?
Yeah, I know. Time marches on. Time marches on. And I'm just going to say, as a parent, it is fraught. And I live in a blue state, in a very blue city, in a very blue district. And I was floored by some of what was going on in the sex ed curricula, so much so that I reached out to local providers here to say, excuse me, how can, you know, my poor son was like, oh, mom, stop. Anyway, that's a different zone. But that is something that, like, on the local level, you know, make sure that you're, if you happen to live in a place that, you know, has abortion providers and clinics in your city and your town, you know, make sure that there are not attempts to roll back buffer laws and zones if they exist. Go to the directors and see what they need in terms of support. Those are things that I think folks can do to immediately protect access in their areas. What do you think? What are some other ideas? What'd I forget?
I would say that it's important, especially for journalists, to support the pro-choice legislators in a particular state, right? I mean, you get so many articles written about how, you know, Joe Q Republican is doing this shitty thing when it comes to reproductive rights. And we don't see a lot of articles about how Joe Q Democrat is doing a lot of amazing things with reproductive rights. I feel like people who are the pro-choice legislators get pushed aside because they're doing the right thing, in my opinion, in favor of these stories about how these other legislators are fucking everything up. So I think it's important to support. If you're on Twitter, shoot out a tweet to whomever and be like, hey, man, thanks for this law. It's really great. We really appreciate it. Another thing I think that's important and that we saw come up with the New York Reproductive Health Act is to push back on the lies. We had an episode about this, on the lies that these laws are intended to approve infanticide, right? Passing laws that shore up reproductive health tend to be looked not favorably upon by Republicans. And so what they'll do is they will make shit up about what's in the law to try and fire people up, right? So apparently in New York, Democrats are just murdering babies. They're just post-birth abortions are all the rage in New York. You know, if you hear stuff like that, push back on that in whatever way you can. If you're talking to your neighbors, write a letter to the editor, write a letter to the publisher, whatever, to the politician. Just make sure that you're pushing back on the lies, because the lies are going to come fast and furious and they won't stop.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point.
Alrighty, our next question and our last question comes from Victoria, who asks us, just for fun, when Don Jr., Jared K., and Ivanka get indicted, what are you drinking to celebrate? And they say that they're thinking positive by saying that they're going to get indicted. And then they also ask, will you guys talk about the Flowers case since it's going before SCOTUS Wednesday, which was yesterday? Mm-hmm. So in answer to the first question, what are you going to drink? All of the things. Just anything that's within reach, right? Like, I don't care what it is. Like, if it's in within my grasp, I'm putting it down my gullet. What are you going to drink?
So I, despite being a very logical human being, I have certain superstitions. And one superstition I have is that I always keep a bottle of Prosecco in the house because it's sort of like, it feels very optimistic. And that's my sort of celebratory drink of choice, right? Like, if I have Prosecco on hand, I'm always prepared for like good shit happening. It's something to celebrate.
That's a good idea. I might start doing that.
That's a quality idea. So my Italian grandpa like drilled that into my head as a very young child. And like, it's stuck with me. It was formative. And plus, you always have Prosecco on hand, which is fantastic. So I keep a bottle of Prosecco on hand for just these occasions. And I would go there now, you know, from there, who knows?
Who knows?
The sky's the limit. But that's exactly. where I start with my sort of backup bottle of celebratory Prosecco.
The world is your oyster shot, right?
Basically.
As for the Flowers case, I can talk a little bit about the Flowers case because that's sort of my wheelhouse, right? Okay, so there was a case a couple of years ago called Foster v. Chapman where Timothy Foster actually got a new trial because of the really ridiculous racist shit that went on during his trial. We're talking about prosecutors keeping notes, talking about how they were striking all of the black jurors. I mean, they were basically coming up with reasons to strike black jurors, reasons that would pass Supreme Court muster. Now, what do I mean by pass Supreme Court muster? In a case called Batson v. Kentucky, I think it was back in 1986, the court sort of came up with a framework by which judges could evaluate the peremptory strikes that prosecutors use to strike jurors from jury pools, right? And so peremptory challenges are something that lawyers use. They're also called peremptory strikes. They use them to remove potential jurors, and they can remove potential jurors for no reason at all. They don't have to state a reason. But under Batson v. Kentucky, a defendant can claim that the reasons that particular jurors were stricken was due to race. It was racial mm-hmm. discrimination. So you get these cases where black guys are on death row having been sent there by all white juries, right?
Yep.
And you're supposed to be judged by a jury of your peers. And if you're a black defendant in Mississippi, for example, and you've gone through six trials, which yep. is what Flowers went through, six trials for the same crime, and the prosecutor is just being racist as fuck, and I mean like just really, like asking something like 45 questions per black juror and 2 questions per white juror, right? Yeah. Asking a juror, hey, do you live in the neighborhood of this Flowers person? The black juror says, no, I don't live in the neighborhood. I mean, I'm like 6 streets away, but in a town as small, he's not my neighbor. Are you sure he's not your neighbor? I'm going to call in an extra witness to testify that you're lying about whether the fact this person is your neighbor.
This
prosecutor was treating black jurors. He was cross-examining black jurors in order to find reasons to strike them from the jury. He did this 6 times. And so what can happen is the defendant can say to the court, hey, look, this prosecutor is being racially discriminatory and I can make this case. Here are the facts and the evidence that show that this prosecutor has been racially discriminatory and there needs to be some action on that. Now, then the burden sort of flips to the prosecutor and the prosecutor can say, oh, no, I mean, yeah, I struck all of these black jurors, but here are these race neutral reasons that I did so. And so race neutral reasons end up being not really race neutral at all. Right. They end up being stuff like the demeanor of the juror. Right. If the black mm-hmm. if the black person seemed a little bit too surly or seemed to have an attitude, which is just stereotypes about black people anyway, then the prosecutor will say, well, his demeanor, I didn't like his demeanor and his attitude was bad and blah, blah, blah. And then that can be the quote unquote race neutral reason.
Yep.
But, you know, you have to realize that a lot of prosecutors will go to conferences where they are taught how to survive Batson v. Kentucky challenges. So the Flowers case and cases like it are good for flowers. They're good for Timothy Foster. They're good for Johnny Lee Gates, who is another black defendant who was who's raising bats and challenges. But they're not good for criminal defendants writ large because they're on a case-by-case basis, right? A Batson challenge necessarily involves looking at the facts of the particular strikes, of the particular prosecutor. And even if that prosecutor has a long history of being racist as hell, as the prosecutor's name is something Evans in this flower case was, they can still skate by because sometimes you get a bunch of judges on the Mississippi Supreme Court, for example, who will look at the behavior of these prosecutors and just be like, I mean, yeah, it's kind of racist, but I mean, what are we going to do? And that's essentially what happened. So,
yeah,
I think the fact that Thomas asked a question during.
Let's talk about the
oral arguments yesterday is huge. I think it's his first question in 3 years or something. And he seemed to be siding with the defendant. So there's a very good chance that Flowers is going to get his new trial.
Yeah.
But the problem is that doesn't really carry over to any of the other many black defendants who are facing racist prosecutors, who are facing racist trials. And so it's like a good thing for the particular defendant, but not a great thing writ large. So, you know, I hate to be a buzzkill, but, you know, I wouldn't get your hopes up too much, even if this Flowers case goes Flowers' way, because that doesn't really say a whole lot about the next black defendant.
Yeah, and I'm just always nervous whenever this court weighs in on anything having to do with race and the criminal justice system in particular. I mean, race generally, right? I mean, this is the court that gave us Shelby County, so there's no reason to think that there's any sort of, like, you know, like racial consciousness beyond in the conservative wing of the court, beyond sort of reinforcing white supremacy as it exists in the law. So that makes me nervous. But I do think this might be an example of one of those cases that's so egregious. We might get some good out of it. So I'm trying to be hopeful. This is like, it's spring. I'm like, we passed the equinox. I'm like working on something towards, you know, that like finding those moments.
And also I think, you know, however way this Curtis Flowers case goes, I think we can expect a really banging decision from Sonia Sotomayor.
Yeah, she's going to have something great to say.
This is her wheelhouse. Like, she's going to, like, whenever this ruling comes out, I'm reading her opinion first. Because I'm fairly certain she's going to write one. And I'm fairly certain she's going to drop the hammer. And, you know, we love you, Sonia. Call us.
Yeah,
come be
do.
On our show.
Call us.
So that's going to wrap it up for our mailbag episode. Thank you to everyone who posed questions. We're sorry if we didn't get to yours.
There were so many good ones too. And some of them were really hard.
Right. And some of them were like, hey man, like, we don't know. But, you know, we'll pop into the Facebook group and, you know, I'll certainly go and go through the questions and try and answer them as best as I can. And, you know, you could always track us down on Twitter and pepper us with questions. We're always happy to answer them. Use the hashtag Team Legal because that's the best
that
way to
helps,
get in touch with
us.
Because my mentions are just, you know, they're bananas. So if you ask me a specific question without using the hashtag, there's a chance I may not see it. It doesn't mean I'm ignoring you. It just means my mentions are out of control. Anything else to add, Jess?
I'm really enjoying the new Maren Morris album, but that has nothing to do with it. It's real good. Go listen to it.
And if I may plug Lizzo, go listen to Lizzo.
Oh my God,
yes. Dropped a song with Missy Elliott, and it is the shit.
There's so much. Yeah, there's great music and arts happening right now, and things are rough. So in go enjoy some of that. It feels good.
Absolutely. Oh, and if you really want to have some really good music, it's Thursday. And you know what happens on Thursday on Twitter for Imani Gandhi? Self-care white people music Thursday. So if you want to go check out that hashtag, I have a Spotify playlist. I've had many white people say that I have better taste in white people music than some white people. And I take
that. She really does.
I really do take that as like a badge of honor. So that's going to wrap up this episode for us. You can follow me on Twitter at Angry Black Lady. You can follow Jess at Hegemommy, Hegemommy. You can follow Rewire.news at Rewire_news. And join our Facebook group, Boom Lawyer.
Do it.
It's all the rage. And we'll see you on the tubes.
See you on the tubes. Boom Lawyered is created and hosted by Jessica Mason Piclo and Imani Gandhi. This episode was produced by Mark Folletti, who is also our executive producer. And the Rewire.news editor-in-chief is Jody Jacobson.